You know, in science, it's very black and white. You have a theory, it's either right or wrong, right? In trading, you know, I mean, you can be right. It's more probability and kind of, you know, run over 10 or 100 different times you do that, you know. You know, trading, you're never going to be right 100% of the time, never, ever. I mean, you know, and I think being right 50% of the time, you can still make good money, you know, if it's about how you trade it when you get it right and how you trade it when you get it wrong. And that's really a lot of, I think, the lessons of actually experience I've garnered from career in trading is that, you know, you need to think about things over the medium term and the number of times you try a strategy out rather than just, you know, something. There's no one trick that's going to work every single time.
Welcome to this week's AFMIND podcast, where we chat with Clive Ponsonby, who, after graduating from Cambridge University with a maths degree, took a daring leap into the wild world of spot foreign exchange trading in the 1990s. This was a time where the world of FX trading was dominated by streetwise and quick-witted traders, most of whom did not hail from academic backgrounds. Over the next couple of decades, Clive secured positions at top investment banks, starting at Bankers Trust, and later moving to UBS and JP Morgan, where he served as an executive director of FX trading until 2018, running a large team of traders spread out across the global markets. In this interview, Clive shares valuable insights into the challenges of effectively using and applying analysis of all types in your work as a trader. Clive continues to trade for himself today and also provides exceptional research on trading and markets as a currency fellow at Header, a platform known for world-class quality research, which is available to professional retail traders as well as institutional traders. You can find out more about Header on the show notes for this week's episode. The AFMIND podcast is sponsored by the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. The STA are the world's leading body for the advancement of technical analysis and run fantastic education programs, diplomas, meetings and conferences on themes connected to technical analysis and trading price action. You can find out more about them on their website, technicalanalysts.com. As our sponsoring partner, the STA are delighted to offer listeners of the AFMIND podcast a discount on their outstanding STA Home Study Course and STA Home Study Course and Diploma Program. You can find out details about this by going to the AFMIND blog, which you can find at alphamindblog.blogspot.com, or just Googling AFMIND blog, and then go to the link STA Home Study Course at the top of the page. Now on with this week's podcast.
We're delighted to have Clive Ponsonby with us, currently a Forex Fellow at Header and author of their monthly series Currency View, which we understand is very well read and highly regarded across the industry. He has over 20 years' experience in foreign exchange trading and the associated risk management, market making in G10 as part of that story for the emerging markets area, particularly. Previously a foreign exchange trader at JP Morgan Chase and was responsible for spot forwards, non-deliverable forwards and rate products for the bank, leading a global team in various time zones. He began his career in UBS from a foreign exchange point of view, again in the emerging markets area, and ultimately went out to run the Asian FX team at JP Morgan as well. So lots of background there that we want to dig into. He's also a foreign exchange consultant, by the way, advising clients on managing FX. So I think we're going to hear some of that story evolve as we go through today. But I just want to hand over to Clive, really, and sort of ask that question that we ask many of our guests on the podcast. So where did it all begin? At what point did it start to make sense for you in terms of you sort of finding this niche in ultimately ended up in what you're doing, which is more of a macro sense? Where was the starting point for you, Clive?
Well, I think thanks for having me on the show, by the way. It's nice to speak to you guys. I think it kind of all happened a little bit not by design, more by kind of serendipitous accident, as much as anything else. I was at university, Cambridge, and all of the people who were going into these kind of high-powered careers, it was management consultancy or banking were the two kind of main options people were going into unless they were staying on in academia. You know, at the time, the way you got into the industry, was doing an internship, normally in your penultimate year, penultimate summer, and then you applied for things. And I was kind of a maths geek, I would probably best describe it. You know, I was doing maths at Cambridge. It was a very academic viewpoint, not really a kind of a street smart kind of subject. And, you know, so ending up on the FX spot desk, which is kind of almost the antithesis of this in kind of 1990s trading environment at a bank, was a kind of happy accident in a way. So, you know, I did internship which at Bankers Trust, which is long gone, absorbed into Deutsche and then various other places. But they were a bit of a trader's bank at the time, quite well known. And I was doing kind of a mathematical modelling research on the side of the trading floor. And working with spreadsheets, writing macros and this kind of stuff. And we're actually kind of coming up with a slightly more accurate options pricing model, because as you probably know, Black-Scholes doesn't really describe the reality of markets. We were trying to improve on it basically, and in a way that could actually be, you know, have a closed form solution and this kind of stuff. And they were fitting the data to markets. But, you know, being on the edge of the floor, we were able to kind of talk to some of the traders, and it was fabulous. You know, the noise and the buzz on the floor. You know, I remember, you know, non-farm payrolls, the big economic number of the month, you know, on Friday, first Friday of the month. And I just remember, you know, hearing that everything go quiet, and then you would hear out of one of the broker boxes at the time, but it was some of the speakers had been like, someone was playing like the Ride of the Valkyries in like the 30 seconds kind of coming up to the number coming out, because everyone would, you know, just be waiting for this thing. And then it would just be, you know, carnage and just noise, a wall of noise, everyone shouting to get attention and, you know, mine, yours, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it was just, you know, I asked to spend a week, my last week, with one of the traders, and I sat on the equity derivatives trading desk, and you got to experience some of just the buzz, and, you know, just knew this is what I want to do. You know, this is much more fun, much more going on, much more exciting, and this is what you kind of used to see. It kind of almost felt a little bit like an evolution of like the kind of floor trading you used to see on kind of the 80s, and, you know, things like, you know, some of the films you used to see. And it's kind of it just, you know, that's what I wanted to do. So you know, then, you know, you go through the application process the following year, and you know, I applied. The place I'd worked at, they wanted me to do like a mathematical modeling thing again. They liked what I did, but they didn't want me on the trading floor, and I kind of turned that down. And it was kind of a bit of a happy accident in a way. I ended up on spot trading. Back in those days, you had to do there was no online kind of testing. You had to turn up in person to do a numeracy test before they even considered you. So, you know, I popped on the train down to London in some kind of hotel conference room, and there was, you know, maybe 150, 200 people all sitting this kind of multiple choice kind of maths test. And, you know, obviously maths, this was Ethereum walk in the park for me. I wasn't expecting it to be a problem. I did maybe five or six of these things through various applications. And I'd done one a few weeks before the one I did for UBS, and the biggest problem I had with it was actually finishing it in time, because they obviously put quite a lot of questions, actually not expecting people to finish them to really differentiate the top end. And I didn't finish it, but, you know, I still got the letter through saying, oh, you passed the university test, come to interview in 3 weeks time or whatever. So doing this next one, I thought, right, well, okay, I've got to do this fast. That's the biggest limitation here. So, you know, I kind of gave myself 45 seconds per question, rattled them off, you know, stopped on a few, left a few behind, and said, you know, right, okay, I'll come back to those at the end if I've got time. And then, you know, ended up, you know, able to go back, finish the ones, go through and check everything, finished it, still had a few minutes left. And I was like, okay, I've aced this, you know. So go back to, you know, back up on the train. A couple of days later, a letter comes through the post. Sorry, you failed to pass the numeracy test. You know, the high caliber of candidates, you know, no longer taking your application forward at this time. And I almost laughed at this. I was like, there's a mistake. So I rang them up, actually rang up the HR department, said, you made a mistake. You've sent me through this letter saying I failed the numeracy test. I didn't fail that test. I passed it with flying colors. You know, you go back and check. And they're like, no, sorry, you know, it's all computer marked. You know, it's all, you know, you didn't get enough results. No. Check again. And they, what they'd done was the results were all truncated as a percentile. and it was just truncated to the last two figures. So when I got 100, it just appeared as 00 on there, on their things. So they rang back a couple of days later and said, "Yes, sorry, we did make a mistake. Can you come in to meet you, you know, tomorrow or whatever?" And I think that was really what got me onto this kind of onto the kind of more old fashioned desk in a way, because they saw someone that was smart but also had guts to kind of question things and actually call them out on it. And you know, so I joined a desk which was about 30 odd people at the time. And I was the only, I was a second graduate on the desk, and the only other one was the guy that joined a year beforehand. And most people left school at 16. You know, they'd learned through the school of hard knocks and, you know, kind of often gone through back office jobs or from broking side to trading. You know, it was all kind of gut feeling and, you know, mind yours and shouting and, you know, kind of very much feel for things rather than kind of any kind of analysis. So I was very much you know, a square peg in a round hole at the desk in some ways. But I think because of the way things evolved, I was actually one of the perfect fits, because I was able to then, you know, I had this kind of, I had to learn how to do this, which is very much not my comfort zone, how to trade in a market where it is just you against everyone else. But then, you know, also as things evolved to become much more, you know, we moved to much more electronic trading and things like this. And as we moved to AI and algos and, you know, the way trading happened completely evolved from paper tickets to kind of, you know, algorithmic algos and AI. So, you know, it's nice to have been probably in exactly the right place at the right time in a way.
Yes, I think if Steve and I had to pass the maths test to get into the city, we probably wouldn't be in the city. that's probably maths to work with.
Well, that's not true, Mark. I did have a minor maths test when I joined, but it was in a pub.
Oh, what?
And they said, this guy can add up, give him the job. And that was a mid-80s type of interview.
Different. Yeah, well, horses for courses. And, of course, we need huge variety, don't we, in these ecosystems of trading to cover the various different lenses.
I think that's the key thing. You need lots of different styles of trading, you know, to make a desk work. If everyone trades the same way, it's just, you know, everything's going to be correlated. You know, you need 10 different traders doing 10 different things to make a balanced desk.
Well, indeed. And perhaps a question for you. And into that, I guess I want to find that sort of nugget from you in terms of when you started to make sense of things, what sort of process were you going through to make sense of things in what analytics means to you? I think, because of course, yeah, we've got an audience that a lot of are trying to maybe work some ideas out for themselves. So it's a process I'm quite interested in for you to reveal here.
I mean, so I'm on the autistic spectrum. So my whole life has been trying to fit rules to different situations. And, you know, trying to work out what people are doing and how they do it was, you know, is always been a bit of a challenge. But I've always therefore been, you know, coming up with rules of how things work, writing down, you know, all the data I can, you know, to try to recreate how other people do things. And so, you know, when it came to, you know, financial markets, I thought this is ideally suited for this. You know, it should be following some kind of rules. I mean, I found out that, you know, it wasn't quite as logical or following rules in terms of market moving. You know, there's a lot of random noise within that, and that's actually where a lot of the value is as well. But really, I watched what other people did, and I asked them to, you know, explain how they traded, how they did it. And it's quite hard for a lot of people to actually put that down into words of, you know, the style and how they make their decisions. But that's very much what I was digging down to. And I think, you know, I tried different things out for myself. And, you know, trying and failing, I think, is one of the best teachers. But I think as well, you know, I think that's the lesson that people can learn when they're trying to trade. You can try and follow what other people are doing, but it'd be very hard to copy someone's style exactly. And I think you do just have to kind of try a few different things on for yourself and see what works for you. And when you find something that works, then I think it's what works for you. And I think there's as many, you know, for every trader, everything's going to be slightly different, how they make their decisions, how they come up to that. And some people will be very much just gut feeling. They'll just be, you know, get a feel for just from price action. That's a very powerful indicator, but it's really hard to describe to someone what price action is and how to kind of look at that and take cues from that. And I think, you know, a lot of people would then look at technical analysis to give them a kind of framework to analyze this. And in some ways, that's what I think see technical analysis as, is kind of a way of describing kind of the human price action that goes into a market and come up with a set of rules from that, you know, to kind of encapsulate when something's, you know, getting to a level which is a bit sticky and will take a bit more to get through. So I think, you know, and I think that's where, you know, for my own trading now, I'm much more kind of multi-day, multi-month or multi-week, multi-month type views rather than kind of intraday stuff. And I think that's where, you know, I think it's one of the first places you should start is just look at a chart from what you're trying to trade, and just kind of, you can see a few cues from that. It doesn't take much to do that. But really just my general stuff, I don't get too involved in it, but I'll look at, I'll draw lots of straight lines on charts, you know, trend line supports, previous highs, previous lows, that kind of stuff as levels to watch out for. And I think there's a lot of people who I worked with who were very skeptical of technical analysis, you know, they would, but I think it's one of those things where it has a certain critical mass of people who believe it, that it actually then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if enough people think that if level, you know, if the 80 level goes in this whatever product, it's going to gap higher, then, you know, a lot of people will leave their stops and trade accordingly if the 80 level does go. So, you know, almost, and the act of these people buying on that break will actually mean that it will do that. So even if you don't understand technical analysis or don't see why it should work, I think it's something that you have to be looking at and taking some cues from. And it's a very good way of picking a stop loss, you know, when, you know, the first thing any trader should be doing when you enter a position is knowing where your stop loss is. And I think it's good to just sometimes zoom out and take a look where you're wrong.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Clive. And again, welcome to the show on my behalf. And thank you for that fantastic introduction. I'm going to just follow up on a couple of points you said there. I love the idea of technical analysis as a framework. And there's lots of different, you know, philosophies of how to use analysis, how to apply analysis. And I think we all kind of have a natural draw to fundamental analysis because it kind of fits in with, I think, how we learn generally when we're young, that there's a story, an explanation, a theory, and you know, a rationale for that. Whereas technical analysis challenges a lot of people because it's, you know, that there is not always a story there. I mean, we can build a story around the price action. But it doesn't always fit naturally. And I remember when I first got introduced to technical analysis as a trader back in the 90s, that I was instantly very skeptical and at the same time instantly hooked on how, you know, it suddenly seems to also that there's something there. And I remember being a trader, I was at Credit Suisse at the time, and we had a couple of really good technical analysts. But the traders sort of took no real interest in what she said. There was a couple of them, they were both women at the time, but what they said might be a better explanation. And yet I noticed how often at key turning points they were right. So there was definitely something there that got my attention. And I think that's kind of what it is. It captures the sentiment in a market. Maybe when there's too many buyers or too many sellers, even if it's a story that is going higher, it gives you that sense of a market just has too many people long here and it needs to, you know, sort of, it needs to have a bit of a clear out, was how they used to describe it, a sell-off before it can go up again.
Yeah, when you look at things like RSIs, you know, they're trying to encapsulate that kind of idea, you know.
Yeah. But you could always see that in the price action. I mean, we were always told, look at the secondary indicator, and I sometimes got overly hooked on the secondary indicators. But actually, you can just see that in the price action as it kind of fades away and it stops making each high is a little bit less behind it. But it keeps rolling higher, and then eventually it breaks and it falls away. And you often see that that is what you see in the RSI or the MACD or the other momentum indicators.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting. We often, you know, I think particularly nowadays in FX markets, it used to be much more gradual, the moves. You tend to get markets just kind of gap from one level to the next level, and then they'll kind of stay in a zone for minutes or hours, and then they'll kind of gap again, you know, to the next one. I remember, you know, when I was trading earlier, you could get onto a move much more easily when you could see something kind of starting to move, a bit of momentum going. It's very easy to get on the back of that. Now it's much, much harder. It kind of just seems to that move just happens almost instantaneously and adjusts to the new, you know, to the new whatever the new level's going to be. And I think, you know, in a way, you know, these indicators give you a sense of kind of encapsulating the kind of, because it gaps to a level, you suddenly find liquidity. If it's going up, it suddenly finds a wave of sellers, and that will absorb all of the buying demand that was there to take us to that point. And then unless there's new buying demand, it's going to run out of steam, and then it's probably likely to come off, you know?
Yeah.
It's interesting technical analysis, isn't it? I guess just to sort of reflect back on. So I remember back in sort of 82 on, you know, the initial days of the live trading floor as a pit trader, as a non-mathematician, just to reemphasize that point. But this chap turned up from Chicago, and I just started, this guy was drawing pictures, and I was, my art side of my mind, I said, well, that's interesting. There's somebody creating art of the movement and the pulse of the market. And I got that was very attractive to me, to start to look at a market from a artistic sort of spatial awareness point of view. And we're still quite, you know, relatively young in my career, being able to have a pretty sensible view about things, and a sense of direction, that ended up becoming sort of quite a popular Reuters page as we turned to Reuters to put these things out. But it was the fact that it was almost a release, you know, that the technical heavy numeric environment that you sat within, and sort of the charting or technical analysis was sort of a release to just observe things in a, I don't know, just a way that connected with me, and I could connect with it and then share it in a language that people understood. So it became like a communication device and a sort of a credibility thing as well. And I'm really interested to hear how your mathematical mindset was also dealing with perhaps an artistic mindset of technicals as well. Did you see it as something that gave you another dimension that perhaps wasn't so clear in the mathematical world?
I think it's interesting. I mean, just looking at a chart, which is trying to, a lot of the time, and some of these indicators that are trying to encapsulate the price action, I always felt that actually living the price action and, you know, hearing it and, you know, kind of the connection when you're trading every pip in the market gave you a better sense of that than a chart could ever do. But what I found really interesting, you know, as the technical analysis seemed to evolve, you would get all these kind of, I mean, I could throw in all sorts of examples, but, you know, like DMARC indicators, and you get these kind of like Elliott waves where it kind of almost, it becomes predictive. You know, it's predicting that if it does this, you know, if it makes this kind of pattern, then this kind of pattern is going to, you know, follow from it. And I found that really interesting, again, more from a, not so much thinking about it artistically, thinking about it as being some way of almost like a model that's a computer model that's kind of found out what the, you know, spitting out the right answer of what the next thing's going to be. Almost like, I mean, before we had the concept of AI, almost what, you know, kind of AI would tell you what's going to happen next, you know, like predicting the weather. And I think these things really interested me, and I kind of, but a lot of them, it's very easy to fit, to look back and fit a pattern to what's happened in the past. When you're actually in the moment, seeing a pattern play out in real time, is much, much harder, and it's much less clear. It's really easy when they show you examples of these patterns playing out. And yes, if you know this at this point, this predicted this, and then it actually happened, and you know you can see it happen. But it really takes a real leap of faith to then actually trade on the back of that when it hasn't played out yet. And I think, I mean, that was what really got me interested in kind of delving a bit deeper into this stuff, because I think, as I say, a lot of it, I felt that the price action was understood better by living it than kind of looking at it on a chart. But I think actually when it becomes predictive and these predictions have some value, then it's really powerful, and it's something which you can't then ignore. You know, you can't just say, oh, I know more than this. You know, I think maybe because of my maths background, I did have a feeling that there was some deeper meaning to these numbers that were flashing up on screens all the time. You know, there was some kind of meaning, or you wanted to believe there was a meaning to it. So I was maybe more able to be more a willing convert to this kind of stuff than maybe some other people.
I guess Fibonacci probably would have helped you out there slightly.
Exactly.
It's an interesting turn of phrase when you say leap of faith. How is a mathematician, or how does that fit in with a mathematician's mindset?
Well, I mean, a lot of maths in physics example, you know, the way to test it, you come up with a theory and then you make a prediction that hasn't happened yet, and then you see if it happens when you put those conditions at play. A lot of science in particular, not so much maths, but is about making predictions and then seeing how they play out. So yeah. It very much is you know, appeals to my kind of the scientific mindset, scientific method of coming up with a theory, making a prediction, and seeing how that plays out, and you know, taking that leap of faith that you believe that your theory is right. But yeah, I think that's the hard thing about that when you compare those two things, though, is you know, in science it's very black and white. You have a theory, it's either right or wrong, right? In trading, you know, I mean, you can be right. It's more probability. And kind of you know, run over 10 or 100 different times you do that, you know. You know, trading, you're never going to be right 100% of the time, never, ever. I mean, you know, and I think being right 50% of the time, you can still make good money, you know, if it's about how you trade it when you get it right and how you trade it when you get it wrong. And, you know, this could be a useful predictor, but it's never going to be right 100% of the time. And really, you have to... And that's where it is a leap of faith, I think, as much as anything else, because you have to have the faith that when it goes wrong, it's not doesn't mean you should immediately junk it, because, you know, the best traders are only right, you know, you can be a good trader and be right 50% of the time. That's how you trade it when you're right and how you trade it when you're wrong that makes the difference. And the best trades I knew would be, you know, at best getting it right 60% of the time. So, you know, every thing, even if it's perfect, is going to come up with wrong answers in trading a lot of the time. And that's where you have to have persistence and think about it over a series of, you know, 10 or 100 trades rather than just one trade. If it goes wrong, ignore that one and move on. And that's really a lot of, I think, the lessons of actually the experience I've garnered from a long career in trading is that, you know, you need to think about things over the medium term and the number of times you try a strategy out, rather than just, you know, something. There's no one trick that's going to work every single time.
That's hence our catchphrase we say often: next 1,000 trades,
yeah,
not next one trade. But listen, this has been great. I've got a question I want to ask you. Before I do, I have to come back to something you said at the very beginning, because. Non-farm payroll day. I'm not sure there's anything quite in the world that prepares you for that when you're in a trading room or on a trading floor for your very first non-farm payroll day. It is quite a moment. And you reminded me of that. And then you talked about the ride of the Valkyries. Now, I don't know if you've triggered something in my memory, but I'm sure I remember hearing that playing over the speakers. At some point on our spot desk in the distance, but maybe I want to believe that is what happened. But it was just such an incredibly vibrant moment. Everything came down to that one point. The room went to a hush, and then the number came out, and then it just exploded in ways that you just, you almost can't describe. And you felt that hooked you. Was that what you said? That was it.
Yeah. I mean, just, it was the buzz and the noise and the adrenaline, you know, of that, that kind of environment was just, it was intoxicating. The best way to describe it. It was just the, you know, visceral nature of it as well. It was just, but it's brutal as well. I think, you know, the other thing that really kind of attracted me to it was the fact that it was a real almost meritocracy. As a trader, everyone can see exactly how you're doing on a daily basis, a weekly basis, a monthly basis. There's no hiding, you know. You know, you might have a slightly better seat if you're a market maker, you know, to do things, but everyone can still see how you're doing relative to the guy that did it last year or the year before. You know, there's a, you know, there's a real sense of, you know, there's no hiding place. And therefore, you know, if you back yourself and you think you are good, you know, and you've got good ideas, then you can rise very, very quickly. It's funny, it's, you know, the noise of a trading floor is very much one of those things that's kind of gone away, you know, over the years. And I remember, you know, when I kind of left in 2018, you know, one of the comments was, it's going to be a lot quieter around here with you gone, because I was still slightly old-fashioned. You know, when something was going on, I'd be shouting out, you know, this is happening. And you know, a lot of people would be like posting messages onto Bloomberg chats, which go out to the salespeople rather than actually standing up and shouting. But I was kind of like, you know, that was what I was brought up in, you know, people would shout when something interesting was going on. And it's funny, I remember there was a day in, I think it was early 2014 or 2015. Yeah, early 2015 when the Euro Swiss floor went.
Oh, God.
Euro Swiss. The S&P had been...
Wasn't it?
Sorry?
January the 15th, if I remember.
Exactly. Yeah. They'd been holding Euro Swiss above 120 for months. And then they just let it go one morning. And it was one of those things where, because obviously everything was on the G10 side, was all the electronic trading at that stage. And it dumped from 120. People thought if it goes, it would go down to like 110, maybe, you know, like a 10% move. That was kind of a big move in those days. And the thing went down to the 70s. You know, it dropped like 40% in minutes. And the guys who were actually trading the Swiss and the Euro, all the G10 trades, I was doing Asian EM at the time, they couldn't put bids and offers in because it needed the big figure. And because the thing was like five big figures wide, the price was five big figures wide, their systems wouldn't let them do it. And they weren't used to having to put big figures in. But I was trading EM, where I had to put big figures in all the time. So when I actually saw it, you know, and I bought some, it's my one of my quickest million in trading. Having seen it kind of base in the high 70s and then go back up, I bought 10 at 89 the figure, that is. Because it was just trading in big figures. There was no one was trading anything less than that. And literally 2 minutes later, I sold five at 98, so almost 10% higher. And it was, the five I sold was to the SNB, Swiss National Bank. So I was then shouting out, the SNB's intervening, you know. And it was like, again, you know, it's, as I did in those days, I was the one shouting out. And yeah, it wasn't the Euro trader or the Swiss trader, you know, who knew what was going on. I was the one that knew what was going on, because I was, and I was shouting out about it. Again, it was up, at 1 minute later, I was selling my balance at 104. So it went from 89 to 104 in 3 minutes. And I made about, you know, 12-13%.
We will return to this fascinating podcast shortly. If you are planning to upskill yourself as a trader or an analyst, or want to improve your chances of landing a job in the finance industry, the STA Home Study course may be what you are looking for. Developed by many of the leading minds in technical analysis and based on the STA's diploma program that was delivered at the London School of Economics, this course may be ideal for you. AlphaMind listeners can obtain a discount on the cost of this course. To find out more about this offer, Google AlphaMind Blog or go to alphamindblog.blogspot.com and hit the STA Study Course tab at the top of the screen. Now back to the podcast. Wow. And I'm so glad you've said this for personal reasons. Okay. And I'm going to put this out there now. And maybe you can back me up. Okay. I've just written a book. Okay. I've mentioned it a couple of times before on this podcast. It's going to be out in January. It's called Mastering the Mental Game of Trading. Okay. And in it, I talk about that day. Now, I wasn't actually trading anymore on that day. But if you've ever been in the FX markets, you will know about that day. And I know some clients who traded through that day. And so I've got one of their stories, which I've shared in the book, which is actually a good story. But I recall that the prices traded much lower than they were actually ever registered and are registered anywhere on any chart system. And I think you've just verified that for me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can remember the certain days that etched onto your memory as a trader. And it traded a few times in the 77, 78. It did actually print on EBS, which was the main electronic venue for Swiss trading, at 0.0001.
Wow.
Which was cancelled, obviously. You know, that we would check, but it traded several times below 80. But maybe five, six, seven times, you know. But there were plenty of trades in the low 80s, 80 to 83. And it was when it kind of turned back up. That's when I think when I bought the 1089, it was 84, 89. I just went, mine, you know.
So I'm so pleased you said this, because I mean, the system I'm looking at now at this point has the low at 0.85. And I wrote in a book that, you know, the low is much lower than it is on any systems. And why that's important is anyone who now decides to build a system that looks back at the price action of EuroSwiss, they're going to base it off that 85 low.
Yeah, I can tell you it was lower than that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this becomes a problem.
Yeah, of course.
For anyone who does system, and this is a problem for for anyone who uses past data for a trading system. And, you know, obviously that's another form of analysis. It is, you know, looking back at old data and then building future trading systems based on them. Often the data for illiquid periods is rarely up to date on the system. And we're talking about EuroSwiss as possibly the most liquid or one of the most liquid currency pairs ever through history.
Yeah, and I mean, having traded EM, getting accurate highs and lows was a really important thing, because clients would want to know what's that. And again, it wasn't an exact science. And then there used to be, you know, there was all sorts of arcane things about when options had been, you know, agreed to be knocked out or not be knocked out, where about the barrier triggered, and there's all sorts of things. I think it's funny because, you know, at that point, you know, there was still one primary dealing location where a good, you know, 80% of the trades went through. But now there's so much goes through on kind of individual kind of proprietary bank systems. You know, there's huge volumes going through the big two or three banks. You know, their systems turn over more than EBS does, you know, which is the main interbank electronic system. But there's also many more competitors as well. And so, you know, it becomes much harder to say, well, what has traded, you know, now than it was even, you know, back in 2015.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant.
I guess add to that, though, that, you know, there is this other type of risk if you're building systems in as much as that the exchanges have the power to cancel trades below a certain level or above a certain level in these types of, you know, black swan type events. And sometimes there's a real delay in understanding that your trade has been deleted by the exchange. And we've saw huge problems in the past where people, you know, try to take advantage of perhaps a 4 standard deviation move in the market where things have gone bananas, only to find that they put one trade on, sold it, bought it back at a lower level, to find out that their purchase had been cancelled because it was beyond the threshold point, but the market had gone way above their sell point by the time they got advised by the exchange that the purchase was deleted. So there are some you know, I know that the charts tell you something, but they don't tell you everything of these stories, and that there are different types of casualties in these events. I mean,
we've seen this very recently with the nickel market on the LME, right? They cancelled the whole day.
Creates absolute chaos. And of course, you can't model for that. But to know that sometimes it might happen, perhaps does make you perhaps not get quite so cocky about modeling, you know, because you've got to bear in mind if there is suddenly a movement that is a four standard deviation movement, it might not be as good as it seems when it's on board as a piece of risk, because there's the other risk in the background that it may not be a position at all because it may get cancelled. I mean, the worst trade I've ever seen ever in my entire career was actually a non-farm payroll trade by somebody that ran about a 10 billion euro portfolio, decided to get a bit cocky and thought, payroll, it goes up, it goes down, let's just put these things in. So 30 seconds pre-payroll is giving me orders. So you put a buy stop above the market with a take profit, half a point above that in US Treasuries, and about 10 ticks below the market, put a sell stop with a buy back that sell, I don't know, about a half a point below that. Payroll was so bananas that almost within seconds, his buy stop got triggered on the upside and got filled above the level that he sold. And his sell stop got triggered on the downside and got filled below the level that he'd bought. And that absolutely did happen. And I had to tell him, I said, because the stops were in the system, as it were. And the screen just showed a blank for a while, whilst the data of the exchange was just coming up with the point of the sell. And I could tell him, I know you're filled on all these orders. And what are the levels? I do not know the levels of the stops. And when we revealed the level of the stops to be basically essentially worse than the initiation price of the trade, that was a difficult conversation, but a real eye-opener that those things can happen.
You know what, Mark? You know, hearing that, it's really interesting because that has, apart from obviously the systematic implications of doing that, if you're using a systematic model, that has implications for trading and application of analysis. It's technical, whether it's fundamental, and we're not just talking about price level, but one of the challenges of using analysis is this idea that something should happen, but then in the markets and the real world, it doesn't happen the way it should. Yeah. And we see that with fundamental analysis as well. And, Clive, I'd love to put that to you, where you have a very solid fundamental rationale for something that should happen, but then it doesn't happen the way it says on the tin, if you know what I mean.
I mean, things never happen the way it's fundamental. I mean, this is one of the hardest things about trying to do a kind of macro fundamental kind of view, have a macro fundamental view. Normally it never plays out the way you expect. A trivial example, which I think most people will be able to understand, is, if you get a payroll number, as we talk about it, that's better than the previous one, but lower than what's expected. It's good data. It's better data than the previous set of data. But because it's not as good as what people have been expecting, the market goes the opposite direction. And that's an early lesson to learn. It's all about expectations rather than whether the data is good or bad. It's better than expected or worse than expected, really. That's the key metric which you need to be looking at. And I think generally, when you look at how things should play out, again, another... we always used to. We built one of the first kind of models that would actually automatically trade on data. This is probably back around that kind of early teens, 2013, 2014. And we literally did it on data. So we do it on like payroll data. So we basically say if the expectation was 200k, then if it's above 250, buy. If it's below 150, sell. And if it's within 150, 250, do nothing. But in that scenario, you'll get it doing something, and we'd also put parameters of here's the initial price going into it. Don't do anything if you can't do anything within 0.5%. So whatever, So we didn't want it buying two big figures away when that was too much of a move. Really, and the problem is that you get the headline number, but you also get revisions on previous numbers. And if there's a big revision, that can obviously effectively add. You can also add the revisions to the date to the new number, and kind of come up with a first order kind of, is it good or is it bad? And if you ignore the revisions, then you're not looking at everything there. And so, this thing would sometimes, one time out of three, it would do nothing. One time out of three, it would get it right. One time out of three, it would react as we taught it to, but it would then get it. It would be the wrong decision. And sometimes markets have an initial reaction one direction and then just completely reverse that. I mean, I saw that so many times when you would think that this should be positive for the dollar, for example, and the dollar would go up by 0.5%, 1% immediately afterwards, and then would actually retrace and then end, close the day lower, even though the data had been pointing for a higher dollar. You know, everything in your fundamental view tells you the dollar should be higher today, but because of other factors, it isn't. And those other factors are often, you can't see what they are. It's almost like poker, where you can't see other people's hands, you know. There's you can only trade off the information that you have, but there's a lot of information out there that you don't have. And there may be a massive trade that someone's trying to, sell dollars that day, and they've used that opportunity to do it. And that's bigger than all the buyers who bought from, the macro reasons,
So it's interesting because, obviously you're someone who both writes some analysis and also uses it. What have you learned anything about analysis as a trader from writing it and seeing what other people want from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been writing kind of commentaries and views for most of my career. You know, we write a morning commentary every day, which would go out. It'd be, read by, probably 500 people or whatever would actually read it. You can see who's actually read it rather than just received it and not opened it. So I've been writing my views and kind of a brief thing about why I think this is going to happen. You would get interesting feedback. And I think this is from someone who kind of comes up with ideas and tries to enumerate those and put them into, kind of actionable things that people can do. It's always interesting to hear counterpoints and people, kind of argue with you. As long as it's, done in a professional way, as it were. And I think that's one of the, again, this is one of the key lessons you need to learn, is to listen to people that disagree with you, because you come up with all, you can always find people to agree with you. That's really easy when you come up with anything, any idea or theory on, stock markets or financial markets in general. But listening to the ideas that go counter to that, because that can give you a critical way of questioning your own conviction. And I think sometimes this is why, when you're around other traders kind of doing things, having a kind of the general chatter about ideas and views is really healthy. And that's something that's really hard to do in isolation on your own. And, writing about things, I'm writing, kind of some, a bit more detail now. I write like a deep monthly deep dive into a topic. So for example, I've wrote about the new Bank of Japan governor and, about what I thought that the implications were for the yen. And this is something where, we kind of knew he was going to be the governor in February. He was appointed in March, but his first meeting wasn't until April this year. So, it's kind of playing out over months. So, you can come up with a kind of theory, and my kind of basis was that it probably would be bad for the yen and good for dollar yen, so or euro yen, and that was my kind of idea on the back of it. But actually positioning for that and putting that trade on, you don't just read the article and say, okay, I'll go out and buy dollar yen then, because you need to then you go to kind of like, well, where do I put this trade on? What's the tactics around that? What's the strategy? And that's where you then look at price action, you look at the charts, you look at this kind of stuff. And I think, from the macro stuff, most macro ideas are played out over days or weeks. And so the entry level is probably more important than your at least as important as your exit level. You need to have an idea of, okay, within that, what's my price target? How much do I think this is going to move? What's the right strategy here? And there's a lot of times when you come up with a piece of macro analysis and you never actually get onto the trade, because it doesn't get to your entry level. It doesn't get to the point where you think it offers good value. And I would say that's another thing. I probably half of my ideas don't end up with actual positions.
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting point because it's something which I think every trader will recognize, whether they're new or whether they're experienced and senior, that idea that you get a feel for where the market's going, but you don't always get a chance to put your idea on because, you know, the market just gets ahead of you sometimes. And then on another occasion, you get it on, but the market's not ready for you and it falls away. And, you know, you end up with the pain and sometimes you're forced out of the position before the idea you had starts to really take hold and take root.
And that's always particularly hard, you know, when it goes against you, you're almost more convinced now it's at a better entry level.
Yeah. And one of the things that occurred to me as you were talking there and about this idea of, you know, it's so important to be around other people. And I think, you know, I spoke with our guest at the last podcast. He was a day trader who's just written a book called Cash Rules, Reminiscences of a Day Trader. And we were talking at the end of it about the importance of being around other people. And a lot of people these days don't want to trade with other people. They trade at home or they want to trade on their own. But also I think there's a feeling that it's a lot cheaper to do it that way. It's a lot more economical. Your setup's easy. You don't have to pay desk hire, room hire, which can run into thousands every year. So on the face of it, it appears a lot cheaper to do it that way. But you lose so much that you would get from being around other people. I think a lot of people who started in proprietary trading offices or you know, if you'd never experienced that first day in a trading room with non-farm payrolls, you may not have become the person you became and got sort of intoxicated in that moment. And I know, you know, you were at Bankers Trust. I mean, Bankers was a beast of a bank back in the 90s. It was probably the best trading bank and was a breeding ground for some brilliant traders, quite a few of who are still around today.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something where, you know, I know a lot of people that will do like courses on trading and stuff like that. And I think for me, the value on those potentially is kind of almost the community aspect. You're seeing other people going through the same thing. And you can kind of, even if it's not in person, you can kind of maybe have chats open with these other guys that are going through the same thing. And that might give you a bit of, you know, a bouncing board for ideas and, you know, sharing experiences, because I think as well, you can often think, I must be doing this wrong, you know, I'm losing money or whatever, and seeing other people doing the same thing or making some of the same mistakes, you know, is a useful teaching ground. I mean, it's a lot cheaper if someone else makes a mistake and you learn from it than doing it yourself.
Oh, yeah. Well, 100%. But there's also that shared learning aspect, that social learning aspect. Yeah. Okay. A question again I wanted to put to you, and I'm conscious that we've probably getting towards the end of this, but it sounds like you synthesize lots of different forms of analysis in your work. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I mean, I look at all sorts of things, and really it's as a going back to what I said earlier on, that's what works for you. And I think, you know, I look at a lot of things, as much to question an idea I have. You know, I'll often come up with the idea first, you know, and then read a lot of contrasting viewpoints to test that idea out to see if it's rigorous enough and is worth following. And then you look at all sorts of the other analysis to do it. And I think you know, look at technicals or RSIs and this kind of stuff is a useful thing to do. But it's hard to sort of come up with my method and say, this is exactly what I do. And I'd say I do different things every single time. I think that's the other thing, which is, you know, hard to then encapsulate, you know, because it's never the same.
Sure. I mean, it is interesting because that comes back to the idea of, you said earlier on that it's so hard to teach this because everyone looks at it from a different perspective, a different angle. their own experiences. So how do you tell someone what the right and wrong way is? And again, if I look back on my own experience, you know, I don't think I would ever say that I had one, you know, overriding approach. I'd say probably one thing is that I would sometimes feel something is right at a certain point, having gone down lots of dead ends.
I mean, sometimes you just do have a feeling, oh, this is, I think it becomes when you get the confirmation, when a trade starts going right, you kind of feel it's going right. And also when it's going wrong, you know, sometimes you put a trade on and it immediately is in, you know, your face, and, you know, you just get a feeling I need to be getting out of this. You know, I know my stop loss might be here, but it just doesn't feel right, you know? And I think that's your mind telling you, there's something you missed here. And you might not be able to put it down again into words what the rule you've broken is, but, you know, there's something that's just not right. Your mind's telling you, but, you know, you can't quite encapsulate it into one reason.
So that's intuition.
Yeah, effectively, yeah.
And again, I think, you know, bringing the fact up, you're a mathematician. I think mathematicians are historically very good at that. You know, they kind of look beneath the surface. I think you're almost taught to look beneath the surface.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I find a kind of, I've always had an affinity to numbers, and kind of numbers kind of seem to me mean more to me than just a tool. You know, you always get a feeling from numbers. It's funny, I used to, when I was like 16 years old, I used to do like cold calling to sell double glazing, which is something that doesn't really happen much nowadays. But we literally tear a page out of the phone book and start, you know, reading every number on the thing. I remember, you know, some people will recognize faces or names or words or pictures or smells, you know. I recognize numbers. You know, there'd be a thing where I'd go down the page and I'd just start dialing a number and go, I've dialed this number before. You know, it'd be one because we had a couple of phone books. And, you know, this is just a random string of numbers, really, you know. But I can still tell you every phone number I've ever had. You know, I kind of remember things by numbers rather than by anything else. That's probably one of the key things. So I kind of feel numbers a bit more, probably more, and get a sense that this is I've seen that number before. This number's a good number or bad number. You know, it's almost like the numbers speak to me more than just being you know, a number on the screen. It's meaning behind that.
Interesting how we all think differently, driven by different things. Sometimes we have conversations and we don't understand each other. It's because our background language is different, and our perspective that we bring to the table is often very, very different. And we can confuse each other by not realizing that actually, you know, I'm seeing that number as a cloud and you're seeing it as part of a ladder, and that person there sees it as part of a spiral. Very, very interesting to bring these perspectives together. And of course, making sense of the market is always going to be a challenge, and we must learn from the experience of it if we're going to have any chance. And, you know, we've certainly not stopped learning ourselves. Wonderful. So, Stephen.
Yeah, no, it's been great. Clive, could you tell us, obviously, how people can find out more about you and your work and Header?
Yeah, so I'm basically writing weekly commentaries on FX markets and what's interesting and what I'm looking at, and then I'll do like a monthly we call it deep dive, where I really go really deep into a topic and analyze it. I talk about the new Bank of Japan governor and the impact on yen. I've been also doing things like going into gold and how central banks are using gold, and, you know, the impact of de-dollarization on things like that. And debt ceiling is the latest thing which I'm talking about, you know, the impact on, not so much on the politics behind it, but on the impact on the dollar and how it's going to affect financial markets. You know, this kind of, these kind of factors are giving people trade ideas they can use. And they can find me at currency.header.com. And there's, you know, there's various things you can look at, some of the articles I've written, and have a free trial and stuff like that, and read some of my stuff if you like it. You know, you can dig in, get some more. And it's good. I really like, there's a community behind it as well, where people are asking questions, and we talk to people about that, and there's a dialogue between people. It's not just me sitting in a room and writing something and then just switching the computer off and ignoring everybody. You know, there's a dialogue behind that, and again, I find it useful when people challenge my views. It's a good thing to test your own theories. I'm putting on trades myself, I'm talking about the trades I've got on and the levels and where I'm taking profit or putting my stops and things like that. So maybe other people can follow that and use it as information. I think the way I like to describe it is I'm talking about like tidal forces in the markets. Tide will rise and it'll bring things with it. It's not something which you can immediately action on day one when you read the article, but it's something you should have in the back of your mind, and then it can shape your trading if you're involved in those markets. It's something which anyone that's trading those markets can use and be aware of, and will find it useful, I hope.
Thank you. That's brilliant. And it's interesting because I think we've got a fair old mix amongst our audience. We've got a lot of retail trader clients on there. We've got quite a few new clients, people new to trading who are early in their learning journey. Then we've got some sort of more experienced institutional types, investment banks, hedge funds, and some family offices we have on there as well, and asset managers. So we have a real eclectic mix. Something's come up for me that I just wanted to perhaps just ask you before we leave this conversation, because I'm mindful that if someone puts, I don't know if you're on social media, but if someone puts an idea on social media, it often gets it gets beaten up in about the next 20 tweets from people who don't agree, and they try and shut you down, and they try and close you down because that doesn't suit their view or their worldview. And you've said so much about the importance of actually being open to challenge and allowing a good form to view. And I think that's one of the things that's often missing from the discourse on social media. Do you have any thoughts about that? And have you ever experienced that at all?
I've definitely experienced being challenged by a lot of people who disagree with my viewpoint. And, you have to take that on board. I think it's interesting, you bring up social media and you get a lot of pile-ons and a lot of people with the same view, all kind of going saying the same thing. I think there's a lot of noise there you need to kind of tune out to some extent, because I think the space where this is probably the worst is the crypto space, because there's an awful lot of people who are very almost evangelical about it, and it becomes a tribal thing. You can't question the legitimacy of this, or the view. You can't question the view. And I think that's where, as a trader, I have no particular affinity for any one product or whatever. And when you're buying any trade I'm doing, you're buying something and selling something else. So it's always a relative viewpoint on something. I think that's something which you can even apply to stocks. When you're buying stocks, you're selling your currency to do that, And often when you have a kind of, when there's like an inflationary viewpoint or whatever, sometimes just buying stocks is an inflation hedge, just purely on it's not dollars or pounds or, euros or whatever it is your base currency is. And you need to be thinking about that. It's not just that. I think that's what FX teaches you. It's always something relative to another. But, in terms of social media can be quite toxic in that you do get a lot of noise. I think Twitter particularly, because it's kind of a free-for-all, having some kind of curated comments is slightly better. Different forms like Reddit and things like that, people do ask me anything things on Reddit, and it can be quite, I think it's slightly better than Twitter. But if everyone's saying the same thing, it may just be because someone's all their friends to say, or people with like-minded views to kind of come and pile onto you. So I don't think that's necessarily a healthy thing to take. I think it's better to, what I was saying, it's about reading people who have different views, about reading other people's ideas. And a Twitter comment is not necessarily someone coming up with a different idea. It's someone just having a go sometimes.
Yeah. And I think we forget that sometimes though, or people forget that in those moments.
You need to be hard though. You need to be able to You need to be able to either ignore it or defend yourself, you know, and it's sometimes a futile act to try and defend yourself when there's lots of people shouting at you, but you just need to ignore it, and that's the best thing to do.
I think if you're going to survive the world of trading, you need to have that kind of coat of armour anyway.
Yes, very much.
So it probably filters out that side of people anyway, as it is. Okay, listen, this has been great, Clive. Mark, any final thoughts?
I think it's a lesson, really, I guess, the translation of a personal passion in mathematics, translating into something that's viable as a platform to launch yourself into markets, is a good message, I think. I know there is a big drive, certainly from government, to get people more involved in mathematics. But when my youngest son needed some maths tuition, we knew a maths professor that we sent him to. I know the stuff he was coming back with, even as a young kid, I'm thinking, we didn't talk this stuff at school, you know, about these patterns and these formulas and these shortcuts. I imagine that there's great joy in being able to use something that seems such almost like a stiff type subject and to turn it into something that drives a career. Is very, very rewarding. So I think it's great to have shared that story, Clive, and to encourage others that, as well as learning about markets, you know, just learn about the more fundamental things of pricing, which actually stems from mathematics, because you might find some things there that will help to drive your models and to drive your thinking behind how to, you know, try to make money in this ever difficult sphere called markets. So it's very interesting, Clive, and I think we're really grateful for you sharing that story with us.
Thank you for listening today. We would like to thank our podcast sponsorship partners, Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. You can find out more about our sponsors at our website, alpha-mind.net, or see the link in the episode description. The Society of Technical Analysts, the STA, provide world-beating technical analysis education programs. Alphamind podcast listeners can obtain a discount off the cost of their excellent home study course. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, we'd appreciate it if you could leave a friendly review or provide a rating for the show on whichever podcast service you use. You can find out more about us at our website, alpha-mind.net. You can follow us on Twitter at AlphaMind101 and at AlphaMind102. And you can connect with me, Stephen Goldstein, and my co-host, Mark Randall, on LinkedIn. You can also follow us and can check back over some of our past episodes on the AlphaMindPodcast.com. We wish you the best of luck in the markets. Have a good week.